Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. This is our first show of the new year, 2025, a year many of us are approaching with some trepidation, if not outright dread. When I sat down to plan the episode, I was feeling uninspired and rudderless, not knowing how to continue or even if I should continue. But in the words of Samuel Beckett, I can't go on, I'll go on, which can be taken as an expression of resilience in the face of adversity, or, and I think this is closer to my case, a bow to inertia. Hey, we've come this far, why stop now? So in that light, I reviewed the interviews I did in 2024, listening back to last year's guests, all people I enjoyed conversing with and engaging with their work. That gave me the idea of taking just a few minutes from the start of each interview and meshing them all together for today's episode. Kind of Terry Gross meets William S. Burroughs. And we do it chronologically from our first interview last January to our last interview of 2024 just 2 weeks ago. Here's the guest list in order of appearance. Stephen O'Donnell, Kathleen McFall and Clark Hayes, Rob McIntyre and Elsa Rogers, Renee Denfeld, Miriam Gershow, Daniel A. Olivas, Justin Taylor, Kimberly King Parsons, David Ciminello, Sidney Morrison, Susie Vitello, Scott Nadelson, Diane Greenwood, Michael Keefe, Penny Allen, and Nui Wilson, Francis Lupai Ippolito, and Gigi Little. So, in the hope that all of us find a reason to go on and have a heck of a year, in spite of the challenges, we bring you an episode we're calling Beginnings, which, wouldn't you know, is already in progress. Stephen O'Donnell, author of Half-Light, 1/25/24. Well, Stephen, thanks for joining us in the Cabo Studios today.
Glad to be here.
Now, we did an interview back in 2018 for your book, The Untold Gaze, which was a collection of your artwork, paired with short fiction by an amazing group of authors, 33 in all. In that interview, you said that you paint stories, which I found interesting. What do you mean by painting stories as opposed to writing them?
Well, there's always something going on. The title of that book, The Untold Gaze, is kind of, right there. It tells you that there is something going on there, but I don't explain it to you. There's a pageant or some sort of picture of an event or a moment, and something's happening, but it isn't quite clear.
And that's what the viewer kind of fills in.
Exactly. And that's what sort of this prompt for these wonderful writers to find what they saw there and make something of it.
Yeah. In fact, this is a question that just came up yesterday when I was looking through your blog. And I think it was the blog or maybe it was Facebook. Anyway, you recently posted the first email that you wrote to your now wife, Gigi Little,
yes,
who at that time had written you a fan letter. She had seen some of your work at a showing, an exhibition.
20 years ago.
20 years ago, right. Yeah. So 2003. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, December 2003.
That's right.
And you wrote, quote, "I do my little paintings all alone at home." And then bang, they're out there for everyone to see and interpret for themselves. Right. They're so specific to me and my life experience, but it gives me such pleasure to have people find other stories there. Now, when you read the short fiction submitted for The Untold Gaze, each inspired by one of your paintings, mm-hmm. were you surprised by some of the reactions to your work?
Totally. I mean, they were things I never would have thought of. Never would have thought of at all. It was wonderful. Yeah, it was a wonderful thing. Wonderfully surprising. And yeah, we were just thrilled with every story that came in. It's like, what?
Such great writers.
Where'd that come from? So, yeah.
Now, in the afterword to the new book, Half-Light, you write that you've been making stories your entire adult life. You were a prodigy from the start, gifted, not as a visual artist. And I remember in our interview before, you were saying that in grade school, even in the art classes, were just head and shoulders above everybody
else. I was the art boy. Yeah. That was my identity. Always.
And as we mentioned, you started showing professionally in 1995, mm-hmm. so almost 30 years ago. Yeah. But when did you start putting down those stories on the page? start writing them?
Well, I've wrote fragmentary things before. Nothing I took very seriously because I didn't feel like there was a place for it. And I also have always done lots of other things, music and design and various other things. And it's always been hard to focus on one or the other at a time. And then, you know, when I started showing art, that became the thing. And so everything else had to fit around that. So I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, I got serious about writing things down and keeping them and finishing them, or finishing them and then keeping them. And then one got published online. Someone heard it and said, oh, this is good. And, you know, we'd like to. And it's like, oh, okay. It was a big surprise to me. And that was a boost of confidence. A lot of it has to do with confidence.
Kathleen McFall and Clark Hayes, authors of Kitchen Heat, A Restaurant Land Romance, 2824. Kathleen and Clark, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios.
We're delighted to be here.
Thanks again. Really happy to be here.
Well, Kathleen, let me start with you. Your previous books cover genre fiction such as Westerns, horror with the vampire, alt history, spy novels with Bonnie and Clyde, science fiction with the Halo trilogy. And Kitchen Heat is a romance, a romantic comedy or rom-com in movie terms. What's the appeal of writing genre fiction for you?
Well, we enjoy experimentation. I mean, so we don't like to limit ourselves to one type of book or one expectation. And so through the years, we've, as you've noted, all of those different genres we've written in them. And we moved into romance this time just as to try something new. And because we like the joy aspect of it. Romance is very popular right now, and there's a lot of different reasons why people think that's so. In part, we think it may have something to do with the pandemic and the state of the world, so to speak. And readers come to romance, and there's so many readers there right now with an expectation and a bargain, really, with the authors or author that they will come away from it feeling optimistic. And that appealed to us at this time in our life. And we also, even though we do write in a lot of different genres, there's a common element in all of them. And that is there's a love story in every single book that we've ever written. And it's, the setting is different, the outcomes are different, but there is a exploration of love, the joys, the complications, and all of those things. And I think in the end, that's probably the thing we most like writing about.
Yeah, one of Oregon's greatest writers, Ursula Le Guin,
yes,
was often labeled a genre writer of science fiction in her case, which she accepted and found it, and I quote, a very useful descriptive tool. But she also said, it's also a pernicious instrument of prejudice. In other words, critics often use the term genre to disparage a book. If it's sci-fi, Western, or romance, for example, it can't be literature, not with a capital L. Has that been a concern for you?
I would say that that was definitely a concern, not a concern, but we were aware of it going into it. We certainly saw some feedback from some of our beta readers saying, wow, you're really moving into romance? That seems like quite a shift for you. But as Kathleen sort of mentioned, there's a lot of readers in romance right now, and for a lot of good reasons. And we wanted to sort of flex our writing muscles a little bit and try to engage in that community. It's been very fun and very successful, I'd say, so far.
Return of the Gem, Athena, Oregon's historic theater gets a new life with Rob McIntyre and Elsa Rogers, 2/22/24. Rob and Elsa, thanks for joining us today. Rob from Athena, Oregon, and Elsa from the University of Oregon in Eugene.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Rob, when prepping for the interview, I learned so much about the history of the Gem and all the work and time you and Elsa and a crew of volunteers put in to bring it back to life. Just an incredible story of vision, community, and perseverance. Now, the Gem itself, at least the structure, goes back to 1901, and it originally opened as a saloon and restaurant run by a local company, Jacob Betts Brewing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a Walla Walla company.
And then it became a movie theater in 1909, and I think there's an interesting story connected with why the saloon shut down and movies moved in.
Sure. Well, Athena was, and I think probably still is, a very conservative community in those days. The churches, I think there were five churches in Athena. There was a powerful political force, and they actually managed to get a local law passed in 1906, I think, that closed the saloons, and that was 10 years before national prohibition. So the Betts Brewery didn't get a real good return on their attempt to open a saloon, I'm afraid.
Now, when it became a theater, so that was in 1909, was that for live performance like vaudeville at the time, or were they showing those very early silent films?
Very early silent films, and there was a local band that played on the stage. Ah. They was kind of like a carryover from the Olio days, where you know you would have a group of musicians go out. They go out in between reels and play.
And in those days, before television and the internet, which is hard to conceive of now, a movie theater, especially one in a small town, was a cultural and entertainment center. So the Gem must have played an important role in bringing people together in Athena from its inception to its demise in 1968.
Well, there were a couple of windows in there where it was closed during the Depression. Transition to talkies and the Depression kind of happened at the same time. And that talking equipment was expensive. Nobody had the money here in Athena at that time to make that leap. So it closed for about 10 years. But yeah, it was known by different names. It was 38 when it reopened as a talking theater that it became the Gem. And that's the way anyone who's alive locally remembers it now. But it was called the Dime Theater originally. And then it was the People's Theater, the Dreamland. That's actually my favorite name, was the Dreamland.
Oh, perfect for a movie theater. and then a very poor name or generic name, the Standard, I think, during World War One.
Yeah, I didn't care for that name.
No. Now, what are some of the memories Athena residents have shared with you? Some might still be in town who probably not back then in 1909 or pre-World War I days, but through 1968. You know, it's got such a long history.
Well, we've been at this for 20 years, Ken. So, I mean, I actually knew a lady, she's gone now, but she was born here in 1906 and lived in Athena her whole life. And she remembered going to a Charlie Chaplin film in 1914. She said, as you know, that's pretty early. And I guess in those days, the films arrived by train. So the depot was down the street, and there were occasions where the train was late, so the movie didn't arrive on time. So the crowd would go, I guess, this is according to Charlotte Cannon, they'd go down to the depot and wait for the train to arrive, and then they'd carry the film back up to the theater and show it. So that's the earliest memory we have. And then Charlotte in the 20s dated The Projectionist, and I guess in those days there was no balcony. We don't really have any pictures of the inside of the building from this era, but there was a crow's nest, she described it. She had to climb up in there. And she'd go up there because she was dating the projectionist at the time and watch the films.
Renee Denfeld, author of Sleeping Giants, 3/14/24. Renee, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios.
Thank you for having me.
It's a return. We did the interview for The Butterfly Girl 2019, so I'm really happy
and
to see
KBOO
you again.
And KBOO actually goes way back in my memories. I think actually my first experience at KBOO, I was maybe 12 or 13 and had developed an interest in punk music. And
yes, we talked about that. You were big on the punk scene. You were in a band, weren't you?
I was in a couple bands, and that was when I was 15, 16. But before that, I used to tune into a late night punk show, I think Pat Baume. Yeah, I remember laying on my bed and listening to KBOO radio because it was the only place that you could hear any alternative music.
That's the only music we play.
So this place goes back in my memories, and it's been such a big part of the community. So thank you.
Renee, in the intro, I read Rebecca Solnit's kind words on your new book, Sleeping Giants, which she says, quote, enters into the lives of people who are somewhat stranded, bereft, or disconnected. Many of your characters fit that description, and your understanding and compassion for them comes from your personal experience, including those punk days, but even before that, when you were homeless.
Yeah, absolutely. I come from a pretty difficult background, which I've talked about before. A lot of poverty. I was ended up being homeless when I was a young teenager. I actually got off the streets largely in part to libraries, which is where I spent all my time. I spent pretty much every day in the downtown public library and the punk community, actually, which was a very welcoming community, took me in. Ended up being some a singer for some different punk bands here in town.
Do you remember some of the names?
Oh, yeah. When I was, I think...
That we can say on the radio.
I think so. You know, when I was 15, 16, I was a singer for a hardcore punk band called Sin Hipster. And I think one of our claims to fame was opening up for Black Flag.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. And then later in my early 20s, I sang for a punk band called Caustic Soda.
I think I've heard of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, some extremely gifted musicians. You know, I always felt as a singer that I couldn't, you know, hold a candle to the people that, you know, I played with. I just played with just some amazing musicians. And we played a lot of shows around town, places like the Blue Gallery.
Probably La Luna, which used to be just a block or two from KBOO.
I don't know if we ever... We played a lot of shows at Satyricon. We opened for Nirvana and bands like that. So, yeah, it was just a great community, took me in. So I've always, I think, I tend to write about, you know, they say write what you know, and I write about what I know. I don't have a conventional background. I come from a place of a lot of trauma, a background of, you know, kind of being a misfit. And and also then I ended up going into careers where I help people. I'm a foster and adoptive mother, and I work in criminal justice now. So I think I just kind of, you know, I resonate with people that come from the margins, and that's what I end up writing about.
Miriam Gershow, author of Survival Tips, 3/28/24. Well, Miriam, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios today, your first trip back since, I think, 2009 for Between the Covers. And we're recording this just before your Portland launch event for Survival Tips. So it's an exciting time.
It is. Thank you so much for having me.
Now let's go back, not to Between the Covers, but a Writer's Digest interview you did in 2010. You mentioned you finished your first story collection several years before that, spent 5 years working on it. After reading one of the stories in a journal, you had an agent contact you, and he asked to see a few of the stories in a synopsis. And he wrote back, saying the stories didn't seem all that connected, the collection's theme seemed vague. You weren't quite sure of the theme yourself, but said the stories were about, quote, failures in love. A lot of readers, I think, could relate to that, but the agent thought something else was needed. You weren't quite ready then.
I wasn't quite ready then. And in fact, half of the stories in Survival Tips were in what would eventually become my first collection, including the story that agent sent the query to me of. I mean, and this is like the thing of myth that you publish in a journal and an agent reaches out to you. I didn't think that really happened. But at the time, I was just sort of learning my way around how to write a story, just figuring out half the stories in here are 25 to 30 pages, and half of them are 2,000 words or fewer. So these 25 to 30 page ones are all from the really early years of my career. So 20, 22,
all
23
of the
years
ago. Ones are from
all the longer ones are. Oh, I'm sorry. Except one.
Oh, which one is that?
Pipelines are not pipes.
Oh, okay, actually.
I'm sorry. Pipelines are pipes.
Are pipes, right. And I love the story, so we'll talk a little bit about that.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm obsessed with cults, so we can talk about that. So, So those, part of why I think those are so long is because I think I was writing toward how to write a story, and I was in process doing that. And I think what I was really doing in all those pages is writing toward what I was trying to say. And so there are many other stories from that era and since that didn't make it into here. These are four that I figured out an answer. Like I had something to say and I said it, but it took me 25 or 30 pages. And at the time that the agent reached out to me, I think that I'd maybe written three of the stories that are in here. And I didn't know what connected them truly, because I don't think I knew yet what I was writing about. I was just still, I was a few years out of my MFA program. My reach totally outpaced my grasp. Like, I knew what I wanted to do in stories. I knew the writers I loved, but I just kept not being able to do it quite yet. I was still kind of in an apprentice phase of all these new skills presented to me in the MFA years, and I couldn't.
You had the vision, not the craft yet.
I had the vision, not the craft. Or in each story, I was getting a little bit more of it, and I was ramping up and up and up. But the funny thing is, that's how I would still describe this collection. I say this collection is about people who fail at making connections and maybe try again, maybe don't try but understand themselves differently, or succeed. Like, so it's still, in a lot of ways, I would say failures in love, but I would use the word love very expansively, not just romantic love, but love in friendships, love
family.
In family. Exactly. And I think I would say failures, like I would put failures in a 14-point font, and then like in a 10-point font in parentheses, it would say, and successes in love.
Daniel A. Olivas, author of Chicano Frankenstein, 4/11/24. Daniel, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios. We're recording this just before your reading at Powell's Books tonight, which is very exciting.
Thank you, Ken. It's a real honor to be on your show.
No, you're the first person who've ever said that.
No, that's exciting.
That's exciting for me. Now, in a review of your story collection, How to Date a Flying Mexican, the writer Michael Nava talks about the stories he was told as a young boy by his Mexican grandmother and how they were steeped in the culture of her childhood in Guanajuato. You're the grandson of Mexican immigrants. Were they also storytellers?
Well, I only knew one grandparent, my grandmother, my mom's mom, Isabel. And she was certainly a storyteller. Most of the stories she told fell into one of two camps. One was her life with my late grandfather at the time. I'm named after him.
So that was more autobiographical.
More autobiographical, coming to the United States separately. They had dated in Mexico and then broke up because, well, my grandfather had a bit of a wandering eye and wouldn't settle down. So she left on her own and came to the United States.
Wow, that took a lot of strength and bravery.
Yeah, huh? But they eventually reunited.
The happy ending.
In downtown L.A. at a party on Spring Street in around 1925. And then the other bucket of stories she would tell were, well, supernatural. And
there's an element of that in your fiction too.
Yes. Those kind of stories, kind of seeped into my psyche, and, certainly the kind of stories my own parents would like to tell, because that's the same basic Mexican American culture they were coming from, steeped in kind of a magical Catholicism of Mexico.
I know that your dad also, you've mentioned that he wrote stories, and he used an old typewriter, kind of like the kind that Hemingway used.
Yes.
But he was unable to sell them, unfortunately.
Yeah, he owned, and I now own, my father passed a few years ago in 2020, and he owned a quiet deluxe, a royal typewriter that Hemingway used. So.
Oh, actually one used by Hemingway.
So. Well, the model.
Okay.
The royal quiet deluxe was the Hemingway's portable typewriter of choice. And so my father used to write fiction and poetry when he worked in a factory in Watts in Los Angeles. He was a young father at the time. I was an infant. He would write and write and write, hoping to get published. And he never got published. So he burned everything and focused on.
Oh, he burned. Oh, I was going to ask you if you had read any of his work.
Nothing.
That's
he burned
tragic.
Everything and focused on being a father. He and my mom eventually got educated. They went to community college, and he became someone who wore a suit to work as opposed to working in a factory. And my mom opened up a preschool through the Head Start system. So when I eventually became a writer, started being published, I was already a practicing attorney. I did not get an MFA. I went to Stanford, majored in English.
And UCLA for law school.
And then UCLA Law School, and where I met my wife. And
we have your wife in the studio with us, Sue.
Yeah,
so Sue, you were at UCLA Law School too.
Yes, I was.
Yes, she was. So we met in 1981, a long time ago.
Justin Taylor, author of Reboot, 5/9/24. Well, Justin, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios just a few days after launching the new novel at Powell's Books in Portland.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, speaking of Powell's, that's where we met for the first time face-to-face a few months ago. I had just read your memoir, Riding with a Ghost, and loved it. I recognized you from the book jacket photo and brazenly introduced myself to talk about it. So given the memoir, I'd like to start with a little about your life story. Reboot's narrator is David Crater, a child actor who enjoyed some celebrity as the co-star of a fictional TV series, Rev Beach. And you were also a child actor, getting your start in commercials.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I was born in North Miami Beach, you know, part of South Florida, where a lot of fashion, photography, and some commercials, some film, there's a lot of that business down there. And my mother heard about it when I was an infant, I think, through someone in a new mother's group, that you could make a little extra money if, you know, the baby was in the picture. And the way that she always told the story is this woman she'd met said sometimes you even got to keep the clothes. And that was very exciting for her. My parents were pretty broke at the time, so they just gave it a shot. And I guess it worked out.
You were a few months old?
Yeah, I think about 6 months old. I mean, she was literally holding me in the first photos. I mean, I was not, you know, couldn't sit up. And one of the side effects of that, she ended up getting a job on Miami Vice because she was in the photos. So she got cast out of the thing. She was an extra. She was often in the back of the head. You'd see the back of her head when Crockett and Tubbs were walking through their office.
So you've seen her on TV then?
Well, I mean, I was a kid. I mean,
I was a toddler running around reruns.
We have some of them on video. I haven't seen all of it, but yeah, I've seen that.
And then I think you were in a few movies too. There was one radio. What was it?
Radio Inside.
Yeah, but I don't know. Was it released? I was looking in IMDb, and I wasn't able to determine.
It was supposed to get a film release. They thought it was going to be in theaters, and then it ended up going straight to Showtime, I think, and then to home video after that. I had a copy of the VHS. I may still have it somewhere. I actually don't know whether it ever made it to DVD. It was a little indie film. It was a kind of sweet story about these two brothers and their father. And I played the older brothers.
As a kid,
As a kid, yeah. the flashback to his younger self. And that movie I was in, I mean, it can't be 7-8 minutes of screen time total, if that. But it's, you know, it's a few different flashbacks over the course of the film. The other one I was in was a Sean Connery movie called Just Cause, and that I was actually cut from. My scene was the original cold open of the film. I played the lead Boy Scout. These Boy Scouts are combing the Everglades to find this missing girl. I was the one who found the body and screamed about it. And they ended up cutting it from the film, but they used it in the trailer. So the one time I ever saw myself on a movie screen was the trailer for Just Cause ran with, I think it was Interview with the Vampire. It might have been Disclosure, one of those movies of that era. And whatever it was something I should not have even been watching at that age. But I went and saw it in the theater 3 or 4 times because it was the only way to see myself. You see yourself for 5 seconds and then sit there for 2 hours.
But still, it must be exciting to see yourself on the big screen like
that. Yeah, it was a great thrill. I mean, and it never happened again, which is why I had to make up a whole book about it.
You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Portland, your community radio station. On today's show, we enter the new year with an audio retrospective of last year's interviews on Jonesy. We're calling it Beginnings for the beginning of the new year, and the fact we're playing only the beginnings, the first few minutes of the interviews. We'll give you the complete list of guests in the close. Kimberly King Parsons, author of We Were the Universe, 6/13/24. Well, Kim, welcome back. This is our third interview, and I'm really happy to be talking with you again.
Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here for a third time as well. This is one of my favorite moments is to be on your show. So,
oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I've heard about the book for a long time, and it has an interesting origin story, which I didn't know at the time. You sold the book to Knopf based on a 12-page short story that didn't make the cut for Black Light, your story collection that came out in 2019. along with a one paragraph summary in there, which mentions something about Texas, motherhood, and LSD, which is all I heard about the novel for many years. You thought the original story was rambling, but your agent thought there was something in there that might make it into a novel?
Yeah, I even liked her rambling back then, but it was a story set in Montana, and it was a character who was sitting in hot water with her friend, feeling a lot of anxiety, which if you've read the book, you know which scene I'm talking about.
Was it
about.
Called The Boiling
it,
River?
It was, story? It was.
Which and was the original title of the novel,
which was the original title, yeah. And I didn't know what was going on outside of the river. I only knew about this woman with all of this anxiety sitting next to her friend who was apparently healing and feeling great in this river. But it was, yeah, it didn't fit with the sort of geography of Blacklight. And so we had pulled it out for that reason. There was another story that was about a wildfire in California that we pulled out for a similar reason, and we put them to the side. And then I just kept thinking about this voice, which it's just that she would kind of go off in all of these weird tangents. And she kept sort of saying to me, another thing and another thing. And I had this sense that every time I would open the document, she had more to say. So I felt like there was a narrative there, a narrator who I could sort of sit with for many years.
So you kind of got the voice almost right away.
Yeah,
did that kind of make it through to Kit in the novel, her narration?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way that I wrote the novel was essentially starting with the center point, which is her in the river, and then almost immediately moving to this psychedelic trip, which is also in the center of the novel, and then everything sort of spiraled outwards. So I didn't write it chronologically, or even as you see it in the book in that order, but it started from that center point, and everything sort of spiraled out from that point.
David Ciminello, author of The Queen of Steeplechase Park, 6/27/24. Well, David, thanks for dropping by KBU on this beautiful early summer day.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you described The Queen of Steeplechase Park as fact-based fiction, so I thought we'd get to a few of those facts first, some of them from your own life. So let's go back to you, David, at 8 years old, growing up in Wayne, New Jersey. It's after school. You're watching TV with your mom, the 4:30 movie, which I guess was on every weekday. They're playing the 1962 musical Gypsy, starring Natalie Wood as Gypsy Rose Lee. You ask your mom a question any kid probably would, watching the movie, what's a stripper? And that turns out to be the spark for this book.
Yeah, yeah. I was enthralled by that movie for a number of reasons. One, of course, being Natalie Wood, who was spectacular. My mother looked a lot like Natalie Wood when she was younger, actually. So she was a favorite of my mom's as well. And yeah, we were watching Gypsy. And it was after the Gotta Have a Gimmick number where the strippers teach Natalie Wood, a.k.a. Gypsy Rose Lee, what stripping is all about. And I turned to my mother after the number was over, and she was giggling. And I said, "Why? What's so funny?" And my mother said, "Well, my aunt used to do that." And I said, "What aunt?" She said, "My Aunt Emily, your great Aunt Emily."
Who you knew?
Who I knew, was a stripper in Coney Island. And, you know, that I my eight-year-old brain tried to absorb that. I tried to put my aunt in Gypsy in one of those costumes, and it was a perfect fit. I completely understood. I got it, and it never left my head, and I carried that image and that idea with me for the rest of my life.
That must have given you a very different impression of your great Aunt Emily. What did you know? What did you know about her before seeing Gypsy and hearing your mom's story?
It enhanced the impression I had. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so she was, there's a character in the book, the main character, Belladonna, right. Marie Donato, and she's based on
my
Aunt
great
Emily.
Aunt. Yeah, yeah. And my great aunt was a bombastic, bodacious, loud, hilarious character that by the time I came along was living in California. So she would blow into town literally like a hurricane, like a colorful hurricane, and have the entire family in stitches the entire time she was there. And I would watch her, you know, from a corner or from a chair or from behind a door, fascinated. I was quite an introverted kid. She was quite an extrovert, of course, and was really actually a bit spooked by me. She thought,
because you're so quiet.
Yeah, she didn't get it. What the heck is that kid's problem? But I was fascinated, and I just would observe her and watch her and just soak in as much as I could.
Sidney Morrison, author of Frederick Douglass, A Novel, 7/25/24. Well, Sidney, thanks for taking time to talk with us today while you're here in Portland.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I very much appreciate it, because the opportunity to talk about my novel is a blessing, and so here I am.
And we're fortunate to have you here today.
Thank you so much.
Now, the book goes back 40 years, I so.
Yes,
I
it think does.
So let's start there around 1978. You were a teacher of history and English at the time.
Yes, I was. I was a high school history and English teacher, and I finished my verse version of this novel in 1978. I even actually didn't realize I had done that until I found a book a few years ago that had a congratulatory note saying, "Sidney, I'm so proud that you finished your book," and it was dated November 1978, and I gasped.
Oh, somebody who read the
yes,
manuscript?
That's right. Uh-huh. And I didn't realize it was that long ago. I had forgotten, but I did write this first version in 1978. I obtained a literary agent because of that version, and the version was 1,300 pages, and I had to have it typed because I wrote it in longhand. And then it was sent into the world by this agent, and it was rejected again and again and again.
And her name was Kimberly Cameron.
Right? Yes, okay. And she still
you
has
her in the book.
Yes, and she still has a very successful agency in Northern California in Tiburon, and she made a decision to not have me as a client, and it turned out to be a good thing, because I have now an agent who has successfully found a publisher for the book.
And that's Stephen Scholl.
That's
and
Stephen
Scholl.
Yes.
And, who we'll talk about.
Yeah, with Hawthorne.
Yes, I want to say, based on teaching history and English, you found a nice blend of your interest in historical fiction. And at your Powell's event, you mentioned reading books as a kid, The Last of the Mohegans, Three Musketeers, mm-hmm. both somewhat historical fiction, melodramatic.
Yes.
And you were a big fan, as I was, of the classic illustrated comics.
Yes.
Man, that was my, I think I read Moby Dick that
that's,
night.
That's how I read most of the classics first, with Classics Illustrated. And then I moved on to reading the books themselves, and I had a library nearby. And also, my mother loved reading historical fiction. And so I asked if I could read her books, and I just became enamored of history through that vehicle. And I wrote a historical novel because I know it's a popular genre, and that people's introduction to history is often through that. And I'm still hoping that because of this historical novel, more and more people will learn about the history of not only Frederick Douglass's time.
But Frederick Douglass and his time, and the history of the country.
And the history of the country. Very important period. I specialized in the antebellum period when I was a student of history at UCLA, and it's a crucial period for understanding who we are today. And so when I was a teacher, I really wanted my students to see their active role in creating history, because history is narrative and study and selection and deciding what it means for you. And I wanted to empower my students to feel that they could be historians.
Uh-huh.
And at first they resisted, because they just wanted multiple choice tests and not write essays and do research. But I brought them around. I loved teaching history when I was in high school as a teacher.
Susie Vitello, author of Bitterroot, 8/8/24. Well, Susie, welcome back. This is our third interview, and I'm so happy to be talking with you again.
Thanks, Ken. It's always a pleasure to come here and chat with you.
And the last time was July 2021 during the summer, and it was an extreme heat dome event in Portland. Temperatures in the triple digits. Today, it's just in the high 90s. So much for global warming.
They haven't solved it yet since 2021.
No, but we're 20 degrees cooler, so
yeah,
for the time being.
Thank goodness.
Now, at that time, we discussed your previous novel, Faultland, which was speculative fiction taking place in Portland in 2030. And Bitterroot takes place in more contemporary times, I think just probably a few years ago. And it shares some of the same themes, though: siblings, family conflict, class division, right-wing extremism. Given these common themes in your work, what are reasons to set the new book in the recent past rather than the not-too-distant future?
Well, that's a great question, Ken. I think that, it wasn't conscious. I think it had more to do with how much I wanted to be particular about the politics and how much I wanted to speculate. So Fallland was and is a speculative fiction. So I, you know, I invented a few things, right? Remember the face wands and, you know.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Also the big one, the quake that gives the book
the
its
quake,
title.
Exactly, yeah. So it was more of a fabrication in my, you know, imagination. And Bitterroot could be happening now. It could have been, you know, I set it in Idaho because of all of the legislation that's happening there now. Not only the abortion issue, but a lot of scary stuff about book banning and making sure that kids do not have access to anything LGBTQ, you know.
Yeah, very anti-gay legislation.
Yes. I mean, the libraries now, they have these signs where kids have to be checked in by their parents so that in order to be able to go into certain parts of the library. You know, they're treating it like it's a festival where there's alcohol or something. You know, you got to have the special wristband kind of a deal.
Well, they're probably allowed alcohol and guns, just not literature.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's a little more pressing in a sort of a realism way, Bitterroot, than Faultland was.
And you mentioned Idaho. The book takes place in a fictional town in Idaho, Steeplejack. Mm-hmm. It's described in the book as that quaint silver mining town you pass through on your way from Seattle to Missoula. That could only be one.
Yeah, which
so,
one is it?
So it's loosely based on Wallace, Idaho. So why not use the real Wallace, Idaho in the story? I know you've been asked that before.
Yeah. So I didn't really want to trespass on an actual town because, you know, it's one thing to say Portland or New York because those are big cities and
anything could happen.
Right. It doesn't feel as personal. So if you're going to say things that might leave a bad taste in someone's mouth, I think, you know, if it's a small town that puts you in, I don't know, the kind of territory that I didn't really want to be in. So, and also I wanted the freedom for the landscape. And, you know, I made it closer to Coeur d'Alene than Wallace is. And, you know, just for purposes of ease of getting back and forth to hospitals and things like that in the narrative. Yeah. So there were some, you know, functional reasons why I chose to invent a town and also some that just made me feel better about that. It felt less exploitative, I guess.
Scott Nadelson, author of Trust Me, 9/12/24. Well, Scott, thanks for dropping by KBOO on this very hot late summer day. Climate change, I guess. Huh?
So great to be here. A little smoky outside.
Yeah. Oh, bad air quality, yeah. Too. Now, Scott, you grew up in New Jersey in a Jewish home and attended college at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. My dad actually made a similar move after World War II. You're much older than you, going from a Jewish home in New York City to Chapel Hill, which I always found fascinating. What were your reasons for choosing North Carolina, just to get away?
It was mostly just to get away. I'd be curious to hear your dad's story, too. I knew I wanted to go somewhere different, and I felt pretty hemmed in my childhood and adolescence, very suburban kind of place in New Jersey in the 80s, and I just wanted to try something very different. My brother had gone to college at Tulane in New Orleans.
Oh, well,
so
yeah.
I had the South kind of in my view, but I wanted somewhere bigger. And I had heard some good things about Chapel Hill. At the time, I think I was interested in journalism and they had a good journalism school.
Oh, yeah, it's a very good school.
And so I kind of on a whim, you know, picked that as a spot and went down to visit for a day and loved it. And actually had a class visit with a professor who was teaching Milton. And I'd never heard of Milton. I had no idea anything about Paradise Lost, and he gave a 20-minute little mini lecture on Milton and then a discussion, and he was so riveting that I was like, oh, this seems like a great place.
Now, your time at UNC had a big influence on your career as a writer. You said you came to writing through music, especially the song lyrics, and wanted to be a rock star. Of course, who doesn't?
Right.
What music at the time and songwriters were your role models?
So when I first started listening to music, I mean, seriously, it was in part discovering my father's record collection. And he had, when he was in college, he collected quite a number of LPs, and he had access to a little record store that got radio copies of, you know, so really cheap. He got really cheap vinyl.
What was his taste?
Well, he ranged from show tunes to, you know, folk revival and a lot of stuff that didn't really speak to me at all. But he had the first five Dylan records. I mean, and that just was mind blowing for me listening
that
to those.
That was through Blonde on Blonde.
It was huge. It was up to like Rolling Stones. So, yeah.
So a little before that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Just before Blonde on Blonde. And they were incredible. And it was the first time I heard language in a way that really made sense to me, that spoke to me beyond just the tasks I was meant to do in school. And around the same time, I was listening to some early hip hop stuff like
Grandmaster Flash.
Yeah. Even a little bit later, Public Enemy. And then starting college, I listened to a lot of Tribe Called Quest. And then, so people using language in different ways that really sparked interest and got me thinking about words. And I also was very into New York 70s punk and pre-punk stuff. So Television and the Ramones. And there was a different kind of language. It was just all energy.
Cat in the new novel named Verlaine.
That's right.
Not
that's
after
right.
the poet, but the guitarist
exactly,
in Television.
Because, yeah. My all-time favorite is Television's Marquee Moon. And I love that music from that era and that particular time. It's mysterious and dark and a little gritty and always spoke to me so much. So that was some of the early influence for me, for sure.
Diane Greenwood, author of Forever Blackbirds, 10-10-24. Well, Diane, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios today, and welcome back to Portland. You spent the last 3 weeks, I heard, in Southern California on a promotional tour for the new book.
Yes, I did. It was the last big event for Forever Blackbirds, and then I took a week to go to Dorland, which is an artist retreat center northeast of San Diego, and I worked on novel number 4.
And we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Bird and Eileen.
Yes.
Now, when we met last year for your debut novel, and 4 novels coming out so quickly, it's amazing, about the Carlton sisters, we talked a lot about families.
Yes.
The family at the center of the first book, of course, the 3 Carlton sisters, their mother who's dying of cancer, their father who's an alcoholic. In the new book, Forever Blackbirds, the core family is the narrator, Marta, and her 2 brothers. Their mother and father are both gone, though we meet them in flashbacks.
Right.
And some of your knowledge of families comes from your own experience. You're the oldest of 5 siblings, and like most families, it was not without its challenges.
Right, right. And I also work as a family therapist.
Yes, that was my next question, but I want to talk a little bit about your own family first.
Okay.
So the oldest of 5 siblings, you have both brothers and sisters.
I have, there were 4 girls and 1 boy.
Okay, because there's brothers and sisters in your books.
Yes. But it's interesting, the families I write about are usually not that big. So
the core.
Core.
Though of course, we've got mom and dad, and some cases we have kids, and then there's aunts and uncles all over the place. And grandparents.
Grandparents, yes. And of course, this novel, Forever Blackbirds, is the rough structure is the life of my maternal grandmother.
Magdalena.
Magdalene. Who was a immigrant from a very, very small town called named Kessel, which is just northeast of Odessa, Russia. That area today would all be in Ukraine.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that a little later, too, because I actually have a similar history.
Oh, okay.
My family. But from your own personal family, before we get to Magdalene, is it Magdalena or Magdalene?
It's Magdalene. Magdalene.
Magdalene. You had mentioned, you know, the family practice, family therapist practice, and we mentioned that in the intro. So your knowledge of families comes not from your own life alone, obviously, but from your professional experience. And Tolstoy has that famous first line in Anna Karenina, all happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Now, Diane, you've seen all kinds of issues come up in your practice. Does Tolstoy's quote ring true?
Oh, I think it does. Absolutely.
They're all different.
They're all different. And yet, you know, dysfunction on some level all looks the same. And of course, when you're writing a novel, you have to have conflict. And of course, in my work, that's what I deal with, is other people's conflict in their family.
Michael Keefe, author of All Her Loved Ones Encoded, 10/24/24. Well, Michael, thanks for joining us at KBOO today. We last talked on the radio, it was August 2019, so 5 years ago, pre-COVID, which seems like a whole different era.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that was for a show on Portland's independent bookstores, and you were representing where you work, Annie Bloom's book, great bookstore. You've worked there since 2000, so welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again, Ken.
Now, your work is based in a love of music. Before you turned to fiction, you started out writing poetry and then song lyrics. Mm-hmm. And you're both a musician and a songwriter. You even play in a local band, Budget Airlines.
That's right.
They're top of the charts.
yeah. If you could find the lowest possible chart, we would be at the top.
You know, I listen to some of the music. I'm going to play that, I think, for the intro to the show, and I enjoy it. So.
Wow. Oh, okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Now, some of that passion and talent for music must have come from your dad. His name is Joe Keefe, and he was a professional jazz drummer in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. Yeah, back in the 60s. He played jazz drums, probably into the early 70s.
With some of those, like Shelly Mann, Shelly's Manhole, and some of those West Coast jazz guys?
More obscure than that. Yeah, he's actually the only recording that I know of him being on. He's playing, I think it's like some xylophone and maybe finger cymbals on an album like circa 1970 from this kind of avant-garde singer-songwriter, Esra Mohawk.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he was doing straight jazz, but also innovative jazz?
Yeah, that was just, you know, like kind of a recording session. I think his friend and my namesake, Michael Cohen, who's a pianist, was invited on that session, and maybe he tagged along, something like that?
Well, in any case, he must have been pretty good. You'd be a professional musician in Los Angeles at the time.
Yeah.
Were you around a lot of musicians growing up?
My mom and dad got divorced when I was 3, so I think... that's pre-memory for me being around the
You were living with your mom then.
Yeah. But there were some jazz jam sessions in the house when I was a little kid, so I think I probably absorbed that, even if I wasn't actively around it.
Penny Allen, filmmaker and author of This Rescue Thing, 11/14/24. Penny, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios, and welcome back to Portland.
Thank you.
Now, you grew up in Portland. Was that in the Corbett neighborhood, which was the setting for your first film property?
No, I grew up in over in the Montevilla area, and then after that in Mount Tabor. So mostly at Mount Tabor.
But you had a house for a long time.
But that was my house.
Oh, okay. Later, right. After growing up.
Right, after growing up.
And you mentioned, before we started, we had a mutual friend here, Matt Clark, who does Gremlintine Show and the Monday Sampler. And you had mentioned that you recently sold the house, they fixed it up, tried to sell it for $1 million, but there were no takers.
Right. and it makes me laugh, just like you're laughing right now.
I know, Portland real estate. I can't figure it out.
Well, it was a mistake. What they were doing was a mistake. That's why.
Now, you didn't set out to make films. In fact, in an interview, you said it was a marvelous accident that it happened. How did that marvelous accident come about?
Well, with Eric Edwards and John Platt, we were doing, we had our own television cable.
Right, the community access.
The community access, exactly. And, so Eric and I worked together for quite a while. And I knew that he really wanted to do a film. And I really wanted to do to tell a story that I knew about, which was basically the story of that ended up in Property, about the neighborhood or about losing your house and that sort of thing.
Kind of developers coming in and driving the residents out.
And so it just happened that I decided to do it, and we went for it, and it was a. It was a good idea. It turned out to be a very good idea. It's a very good movie.
Oh, definitely. And it's still around today. Right. People are still watching it.
Right.
Now, unlike you, you were not trained as a filmmaker, but Eric went to Rhode Island School of Design.
Right.
So
right.
He knew what he was doing with cinematography.
Exactly. He knew what he was doing. And I sort of learned a lot about film on his shoulder, or looking over his shoulder. But I did not know anything about it at the beginning.
A Tree of My Own, with Nui Wilson, Francis Lupai Ippolito, and Gigi Little, 12/26/24. Nui, Francis, and Gigi, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, Nui, let's start with you, the book's author and a member of the Karen community. You grew up in Thailand. Were you from a family of Karen refugees who settled there?
I am not a Karen refugee. I am a Karen Thai who born and raised in Thailand. So I came here as an immigrant. So the Karen that are born in Burma, a lot of them are refugees that they crossed the border and came to Thailand. And now in America, most of them are refugees.
What about your family originally? Were they from Burma? Or
they are Karen Thai. They're born and raised in Thailand.
Does it go back to part of the family ancestors living in Burma and making that perilous journey?
Yes. I think if I can recall, at least one of my ancestors crossed the border many years ago and came to Thailand and lived in Thailand after that.
Now, the Karen in Burma are fighting what's currently the longest-running civil war in the world. This goes back to 1948 when when Great Britain, the UK, gave up Burma, or Myanmar now, as a colony. Can you tell us about the Karen and the situation in Burma? It really hasn't gotten any better since 1948.
Yes, since 1948, when the British left the countries, they're always chaotic in that countries. A lot of fighting for their land, a lot of fighting for be more autonomy and freedom. And sometimes, you know, it's really big one. And sometimes it's just like, oh, there's nothing going on in that country. But there is still like fighting. Mostly the minorities want to have their own freedom.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. We just heard an audio retrospective of last year's interviews on Jonesy. We're calling it Beginnings. For the beginning of the new year, and the fact we're playing only the beginnings, the first few minutes of the interviews. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. Or if you'd like to hear any of the full interviews, not just the beginnings, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy. J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to all our guests in 2024. Stephen O'Donnell, Kathleen McFall and Clark Hayes, Rob McIntyre and Elsa Rogers, Renee Denfeld, Miriam Gershow, Daniel A. Olivas, Justin Taylor, Kimberly King Parsons, David Ciminello, Sydney Morrison, Susie Vitello, Scott Nadelson, Diane Greenwood, Michael Keefe, Penny Allen, and Nui Wilson, Francis Lupaya-Polito, and Gigi Little. In this respect, at least, it was a very good year. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, January 23rd at 10:30 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope the new year is kind to us all.